righty, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Nice to see you. There are some new faces. I'm Jim Falk, President of the World Affairs Council. And tonight I especially want to thank our media sponsor, the Dallas Business Journal. They give us in-kind support for a number of our programs, and they were, Mattson, particularly pleased to do tonight's program. And when my good friend John Goodman called and said, would you like to do this? I said, by all means, because I'm afraid that Brexit and related topics will be in the news for the considerable future. How many of you watched Morning Joe this morning at about 7:45? Anybody? So you saw the speaker that we're going to have in a few weeks, Jonah Mendez, former CIA chief of disguise, Moscow rules, master of disguise. It was such fun to hear her talk, and I never heard her talk before, but I've read the book, and I know it is going to be really entertaining. High school students are invited for free, so that we can encourage all of them later to become spies and wear good disguises. But I hope you'll come to that program. And another program that I really want to highlight, because it's not doing as well as we would like it to do, and that's One Day University. One Day University used to come to Dallas two or three times a year. And they had a partnership with the Dallas Morning News, and then the Dallas Morning News broke off from it. One Day University does these remarkable half-day, one-day sessions in about 40 or 50 cities in the United States. And so the president of it contacted me at the recommendation of our friend Jeremy Suri and said, see if the World Affairs Council doesn't bite and if they want to be your partner. So the first one that we're doing is on June 8th. And frankly, I came up with the title, so I wanted to do better than it's doing. We only have about 130 or 140 people, and we really would like to reach 200. It is Saturday morning from about 8:30 to 1 o'clock. And the topic is America 2019, where are we now and where are we going? And one of the speakers is from, Perry World House. And then the other one is our good friend, Jeremy Suri. And then the third speaker is a woman named Wendy Schiller from Brown University. So I hope you'll look at coming to this. And as I've said to others who have heard me give this pitch, the way One Day University picks people, speakers, is they look at student evaluations and see who, it's a really smart idea, and who are the best entertaining lecturers. And the ones that I've gone to are all very enjoyable, so do look at that. Paul Salem, we have just a few spots left for that tomorrow night. Paul is the relatively new president of the Middle East Institute, and the first time that an academic or think tank leader has been the president of the Middle East Institute. When I worked there and decades before and decades afterwards, it had always been a retired ambassador. So do, if you're interested in that. I'm going to do my podcast with him, and normally I prepare questions, and I was joking, I don't need to prepare questions. I can just say Iran, Saudi Arabia, and just let him go. So, John Goodman, president of the Goodman Institute. John and I have known each other ever since I moved to Dallas. So, John, thanks for this opportunity. I think it's the first time that the council has co-sponsored anything with your institute, and I hope it's the first of many. John Goodman.
Thank you, Jim. If you Google Mattson Peary, you're going to find all kinds of interesting things. Maybe some of you have already done it. If you Google Mattson Peary plus YouTube plus bow tie, you'll discover that he has a new way of tying a bow tie. And if you're like me, most of the black tie events that you go to, you have a lot of men like me who have no idea how to tie a tie. We all look horrible. But if you go to his site, you'll learn how to tie a tie that really looks good. You'll be the envy of the next party that you go to. And people walk up to him and say, you don't know me, but you taught me how to tie a tie. He has produced a series of YouTube 3-minute videos called Economics Can Be Fun. And if you go through about 20 of those, you will very quickly learn a lot of economics, and it will be fun, and it doesn't take very long. He's written on a lot of different things, including how to boost your IQ and how to win an argument, and it's quite versatile. Now, I first met Madsen Peary at a conference in Windsor Castle way back in the early 1980s, and Margaret Thatcher was prime minister in England, and Ronald Reagan was president of the United States, and at that time, we had no idea we were on the verge of something really, really big. Madsen Peary was very involved with Margaret Thatcher and her privatization techniques, and I asked him to write a short book for us on Margaret Thatcher's 21 techniques of privatization. And they were short and sweet. If you can sell it, sell it. If you can't sell the whole, sell a part. If you can't sell any of it, give it away. And it went like that with 21 of those. And it was a catchy book. And we published it here in Dallas, Texas. And then we held a conference in Washington that was mainly for other think tanks. I think maybe the Wall Street Journal was there and some news people. It was mainly for other think tanks because we wanted the think tank community to know about Margaret Thatcher's techniques of privatization. And so Madsen was there, I was there, and then we published another book on that subject. And these two little books made their way around. Now, in England, the national government owned a lot of things to privatize, like all the council houses. In the United States, our national government doesn't own that much. Doesn't own council houses, for example. But at the local level, we had huge opportunities for privatization because in cities across the country, we had city after city running literally hundreds of businesses, you know, garbage collection, street sweeping, tree trimming. Here are these cities trying to run all these businesses and doing a very poor job of it. And so our message was, well, you can privatize all of this stuff and lower your costs, get better quality, and that was our message. I remember going down to a Dallas City Council meeting, and the city manager came in and said, oh, we've already privatized a lot of things. You know, look at this pencil, for example. We bought it across the street. We didn't produce our pencils and the paper. We didn't produce our own paper. So there was resistance. But I would say that our efforts here led to a privatization revolution at the local level in the United States. There's been a tremendous amount of privatization since that time. Well, let me turn this program over to somebody who has more to say to you than I do. Dr. Peary has agreed to talk, give a short talk, and then he'll be available for questions because he wants to hear more of what you want to know than what he would like to tell you. So let's give a warm Dallas welcome to Dr. Madsen Peary.
Well, thank you for that. I hope I can live up to your prelude. First of all, when I taught philosophy at Hillsdale, I always used to tell my students, when I finish the lecture, you can ask questions on any subject you want to, not necessarily what I've been talking about. The same is true tonight. And one kid said, what's your favorite game? Well, I'll take questions on anything. It's called Scotsman's Knock. How do you play it? Well, you get two Scotsmen in a room with a bottle of whiskey, and they drink the bottle of whiskey, and one of them goes out and knocks at the door, and the other one has to guess which of them it is. they were still laughing a week later. Now then, this is amazingly fortuitous. I think John Goodman must be psychic because a big event occurred a few hours ago in Britain. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, introduced the new version of the bill she hoped will get Britain out of the EU. And that was done actually today. So I'm speaking to you even as history is being made. First of all, a little bit of the history. Britain joined the European Union in 1973, and we had a vote in 1975, referendum, to confirm or indeed negate our membership. And overwhelmingly, it was carried in favour. So Britain affirmed its membership of, wait for it, the European Economic Community. And we thought we were joining an economic association. And I, along with Margaret Thatcher, voted for that. And then we discovered that there was a bigger agenda there. And that within a few years, they dropped the word economic and it became the European Communion. And then it became the European, European Community. And then it became the European Union. And then they adopted a flag and a national anthem. And we began to realize that we'd been sold a pup, that this was not an economic association. It was a move to establish a United States of Europe. And the aim was to rival and stand up to the United States of America. It thought the European nations individually couldn't do this, but collectively and together they could. And that was the agenda of the European Union. Look at them now. They want to go, they have already their own parliament. They want an army, they want embassies, they want the European Union to have a seat on the Security Council of the United Nations. You know, this is a country, this is not an economic association. Not surprisingly, in Britain, rising dissent, this is not what we signed up to, was a rather general view. Over the years, first of all, Margaret Thatcher turned roughly, it took her 5 years to realize this was not what she wanted. That is, she didn't want the laws of Britain to be made elsewhere by other people than British citizens. The laws of Britain should be made by the people of Britain. It's fairly straightforward. The laws of the United States should be made by people in the United States. Very straightforward. Along came a man called Nigel Farage. Hands up anyone who's seen Nigel Farage on television. Yes, one, two, about half, yes. And he started the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, in order to oppose this drive towards federal union in which Britain would be submerged into some kind of European state. Right, fine. It began to eat into the votes of the Conservative Party, because many Conservatives felt disquiet at the way it was going. This was unrepresentative. Britain didn't have any say in the rules and laws. David Cameron came up with the absolutely brilliant idea of offering a referendum. And so in the 2015 election, he offered a referendum. And he thought that he wouldn't have to deliver. He assumed, you see, he was in a coalition government with the party called the Liberal Democrats. And he thought he would be in another coalition and the Liberal Democrats would say, no, we're not having a referendum. But to his horror, he discovered on election night that he'd won a majority. And therefore, he had to deliver a referendum. That was the worst day that ever happened to David Cameron. For when he delivered the referendum a year later, we all know what happened. The result was that 52% of the British people voted to get out of the European Union. Shockwaves. The problem is the same as you had in the US. A political elite centered in government had very different views from ordinary people in the country. In the case of Britain, the political elite were quite happy to be part of this European project. People in Britain were not. They saw their sovereignty, their ability to control their destiny, passing into foreign hands. And so when the referendum came, wow, despite the fact that nearly every major organization in Britain was in favor of staying in, the British people unexpectedly rebelled and voted to come out. Shockwaves around the world. If you want to put this in a general context, it's insurgency. It is people deciding, we've had enough of these political elites telling us what to do, bossing us around, doing stuff that doesn't matter to our lives. We want to talk about jobs and opportunities and getting enough money to feed our families and stuff like that. These political elites are talking about stuff that doesn't matter to us. So let's bang them on the nose. And that happened, I think, in the United States with the election of your president. It happened all across Europe with populist parties. It happened in Britain with the Brexit referendum. Now, the problem is, of course, that we have a parliament, about two-thirds of whom want to stay in Europe. We have a populace, majority of which wants to come out of Europe. Brexit. So, hence, 2 years of utter confusion. Now, the Prime Minister wants a deal, Theresa May, wants a deal that keeps us as close as we can to Europe, so following their rules as far as possible, in which case people say, what is the point of coming out? The dilemma is that the popular feeling in Britain is that they want sovereignty back. They just want the rules that apply in Britain to be made in Britain. They don't want them made in Brussels by Italians and Slovaks and, you know, other, you know, people who have no experience of what life is like in Lancashire, Yorkshire, Cheshire, you know. It's a very straightforward desire. There's nothing. People try to paint this as if it's some kind of, you know, xenophobic, anti-foreigner, and, you know, it's not. It's just straightforward. People want to control their lives to some extent. They want to feel they have some ability to elect a government that will do what they want to do that's in their best interest. Okay, so what has been happening? That's the history of it. Now, rising sentiment of dissatisfaction in Britain at the way the negotiations are going has led this Nigel Farage, which half of you have seen on television, he started a new party called the Brexit Party. Now, in 2 days' time, we have to elect candidates to the European Parliament. We didn't want to. We thought we'd be out by now. But the rule is that if you're a member of the EU, you have to have elections to the European Parliament. He started this party called Brexit, and good heavens, it's sweeping the board. It's in 2 days' time, the British establishment is going to get the shock of its lives. They're currently running at 35%. Almost certainly, they will get over 40%. No other party will get 20%. This party is going to take the vast majority of the seats. And the British establishment will recoil in horror and say, these people don't know what they're voting for. Yeah, but they know perfectly well what they're voting for. They want to punch the establishment on the nose once again. And, I think it's going to happen. Now, this morning, fortuitously, Theresa May went before Parliament and announced the revised deal. She wants to come out of the European Union, but nonetheless remain subject to their laws relating to the environment, their laws relating to labor relations, their laws. In other words, it will be leaving in name only. And she announced that this morning, at your time, 10 o'clock, and British time, 4 o'clock. And the reaction, of course, has been total horror in Britain. She's going to bring this bill before Parliament on June the 6th, and the odds are very high that it will be defeated. If it is defeated, the rulers of the Conservative Party have said she must resign on the spot. So within 3 weeks, we're going to lose a prime minister. I mean, this Brexit thing is a world changer. We're going to have an election for a new Tory leader. Odds are very high it will be someone called Boris Johnson. Hands up all those who've ever heard of Boris. Yes, everyone has heard of Boris Johnson. That's precisely why he's the favourite candidate, because he reaches into the parts of Britain that other people don't reach. Now, if the sentiment in Britain is immense irritation at the political classes, at Parliament, at politics in general, and the feeling that really they have failed the nation, they failed the people. And so Brexit, in a sense, is the same kind of insurgency that produced Donald Trump in America. It is going to produce a wave of populist parties in the European elections. Now, what's going to happen after Prime Minister is defeated on June the 6th? I wonder if she knows the significance of that, by the way. D-Day, the 6th of June. It is 75 years since largely American, but Canadian and British troops stormed ashore in Europe. And on D-Day, the 6th of June, I think the stage will be set for a retreat from Europe. But what happens after that is anybody's guess. And now I'll take questions, except about my favorite game, because I've already told you that one. So, yes.
Thank you. When the 52% of the British populace voted to leave, do you think there was consensus within that 52% of what that actually meant beyond the very high level return of British sovereignty?
Well, there were polls done. Now, when people say in answer to pollsters, what they think. It's not always the same as what they actually do when they get into the ballot box and, you know, put a cross on or pull a lever in your case. What they actually said was that 48% of them said the issue was sovereignty. 33% said it was immigration. Now, you could say that sovereignty actually conceals a little bit of immigration as well. So some people who want British sovereignty meant that they wanted to control immigration. So immigration might have been higher. But in answer to polls, they said it was a third worried about immigration. Half wanted Britain basically to assert its own laws, to pass the acts and so on. A little bit of background, if you don't mind. Britain, our legal system is common law. It's based on cases accumulated, you know, decisions of juries over the centuries, and the previous decision stands. And our law is not something that Parliament has written down. It's something that's kind of emerged from the practice and decisions of juries. Now, the continental system is completely different. There it is statute law. It is legislators deciding what freedoms people are allowed to have, and they stipulate in the laws, what people are allowed to do. Now, in Britain, it's the other way around. People are allowed to do whatever Parliament doesn't prohibit. You see, there's a completely different approach, and that's why Britain wanted its sovereignty back. We didn't want legislators telling us what our freedoms were. We already knew what our freedoms were. We simply wanted to preserve them and maintain them. But answer to your question briefly, it was mostly sovereignty. Helped by opposition to uncontrolled immigration. Majority of British people in polls now are in favor of immigration, provided it's controlled, provided we can control the numbers and indeed, to some extent, the quality of the immigrants. You know, skilled people, people with technical skills, education, people who speak the language, fine. No one has any problem with that. But it's being forced to accept unlimited numbers of immigrants we have no control over. So, is that sovereignty or is it immigration? Next question. Yes?
Ireland. What about Ireland? What do you think will happen with Ireland?
The problem is that when Britain went into the EU in 1973, Ireland, of course, did the same, and so did Denmark, and there were others. There has not been a hard border between the part of Ireland in the north, which is part of the United Kingdom, and the independent Republic of Ireland in the south. The problem is that if Britain leaves the EU and the Republic of Ireland doesn't, then we have a border because within the EU, it's a there is a tariff wall, a common external tariff, against all goods coming from outside the EU. Now, if Southern Ireland is still in the EU, they have to have that common external tariff. But if Northern Ireland, as part of the UK, has left, ooh, there's a bit of leakage going on. Indeed, there might be a lot of leakage. And if you're wanting to bring goods into the United Kingdom, you might bring them into Southern Ireland first, because within the EU there are no tariffs, and then slip them across the border into a country that's not part of the EU. And that's called the Irish backstop, by the way, the notion that you have to find a way of doing this. Look, the way you do this is electronically. Norway is not a member of the EU. It has a border with EU countries. And the average waiting time for trucks going through is about 5 minutes, because they're all checked electronically. Goods are recorded. They're not sort of stopped and searched at the border. It's much more sophisticated than that. And the obvious solution to the Irish border is something pretty similar. It's already working in other non-EU countries. Why shouldn't it work in Ireland? Well, the main problem is tariffs. The main problem is not statute versus common. The main problem is that the EU, for example, I like New World wines. Wines produced in California. Does Texas produce any wines?
Yes.
Right. The EU imposes a tariff of 39% on all wines coming from outside Europe. Right. That is in order to protect producers in France, in Italy, and Germany mainly. 39% on wines coming in. Now, if Britain leaves, of course, we won't impose that tariff, and that causes a problem on the Irish border because, you know... In America, you have states that have, you know, different state taxes on alcohol and cigarettes. And the rule is generally, rule of thumb, if a family is doing this in their car, it doesn't matter. If commercial firms are doing this in big trucks, then it does. And so although, you know, it's called a leaky border, and you don't mind if people are doing it on a small scale, you object to people doing it for commercial advantage. It'll be something like that, I'm sure, that comes out of it. So. Yes?
And what is the effect on the pound of Brexit?
Ah, well, the answer is...
The
question is, what's the effect on the pound, the value of the pound, its relative standing against the dollar and the euro? And the answer is, it goes down in the short term and up in the long term. Because what fundamentally is the main problem of Brexit is uncertainty. And uncertainty means people don't want to invest in that particular currency because they don't know which way it's going. Once the future becomes settled, then the uncertainty is gone and the pound will rise in value. And it will rise in value simply because Britain will make trade deals across the rest of the world, and we'll be importing goods from countries that we can't at present do so because of that common external tariff, and we'll be exporting to countries that we can't at present do so. So short term, because of uncertainty, low pound, afterwards high pound. So if you're going to put money into this, don't blame me, by the way. Yes?
Being blessed of living in Brussels for 12 years, I watched the whole...
Oh, you're a poor fellow.
Yeah, I know. Except for the good beer. Other than that, and watching the European Union in action, and I use that word loosely. The ERM, the Schengen Agreement, Maastricht, the failure of the Labour Manifesto, the failure of the European Union Constitution, Britain was on the edge out of that all along. And yeah. I was just curious as to... When Brexit was first manufactured as a potential, why wasn't it just a modification of what they were already out of and just took them out of some of the political things? I understand what you're saying about the political side.
Yeah, the answer to your question is that was tried and they wouldn't agree to it. And that it was actually, David Cameron went and tried to negotiate, you know, give us a better deal and we don't need to, you know, to vote Brexit. And they wouldn't do it, so... They're a great believer in the cohesion of Europe. It must all be the same. Now, in fact, Europe is, you know, it's got, the EU has, what, 28 countries in it, and they're all different, and they're all wonderfully different, and they're all engagingly different. And for some reason, people in Brussels want them all to be the same. And, you know, therefore they refused to allow the exceptions. Had they done that, the referendum would have lost. You know, Brexit would have been defeated because people would have been, oh, yeah, they're prepared to make concessions. Fine, you know, good. They're reasonable people. Yeah. The answer is we tried.
May's administration focused primarily on Brexit through its entire.
Yes, it's killed all other stories.
Yes, and so she's been working hard, and you know, hats off to her. She's really, you know, rolled her sleeves up, and she's been working a day and night, and this is the last deal, and if this deal isn't approved, what makes anyone think that her successor will be able to have any deal at all with the exit? In other words, isn't it better now to make the deal than wait till after she's gone to make the deal?
The problem is, and what her opponents recognize, is that if they vote for her deal now, they know that she's going to be gone within a month, and her successor will simply tear up all those things that they've agreed to that she's proposed. That's the problem. Her successor will probably be someone who says, right, we've had enough of this, we're coming out, no deal. We're coming out on World Trade Organization terms. Once we're out, we'll negotiate with you like other countries do. And instead of having some kind of complicated deal, it'll probably be someone like Boris Johnson. He'll say, right, we've had enough, we're coming out. Yeah. Once we're out, we'll start talking to you. So the answer is the successor will make a difference. Yes?
That'll create an economic issue for Great Britain.
Yes, it will, yeah. Yeah, short-term cost, long-term gain, like with the pound. You know, yeah. There's nothing you can't get over. You know, six months, yeah, trouble, and then it starts to get easier. You know, you're in Germany in early 90s. You want to reunite East Germany with West Germany. Ooh, immense economic cost. You're going to have one Deutschmark for one Ostmark. You know, and there's going to be economic dislocation here. And yeah, but at the end of it, we'll have a united Germany. Okay, we're going to have a year of dislocation, but at the end of it, we'll get what everybody wants. It's going to be like that. We're going to have a period of complete turmoil and dislocation. At the end of it, Britain will be out, independent, negotiating free trade deals throughout the world and not paying 39% on American wines.
You have perhaps touched on what my question is. I'm right here.
Oh, sorry.
We always hear about the economic and political impact on the UK. Address more the impact on the rest of the European Union, and does this create a precedent for other countries to exit?
Yes, it does, and that's... That's part of their agenda, you know. Of course it does. If Britain, there are many countries, you know, hovering on the edge. Indeed, if you go to the bookmakers, they will offer odds on whether it's Poland or Italy that comes out first. Netherlands is quite a good candidate. And if Britain comes out, right, and after 6 months of turmoil is shown to be prospering, guess what? Other countries are going to say, well, why don't we go that route as well? And yes, I actually incline to the view that Brexit has lit a fuse that is slowly burning its way to the heart of Brussels, and eventually will change the complete nature of the European Union. There will be no single country, there will be no embassies, there will be no seat in the United States. It will be an association of nations. They'll have to back off from that federal program simply because Britain has left, and other countries will do the same unless they back off. Yes? Uh-huh.
Give us a lesson, if you will, in the British Parliament. If 52% of the British voted for Brexit, why didn't they elect 52% or close to 52% of the parliament to support them?
Well, we've had three votes on this. The first vote was in 2015 when the Conservative Party said, vote for us and we'll give you a referendum on European membership and we promise to deliver what you vote for. And they voted to elect Cameron's government, to his horror. He'd assumed that he'd have Liberal Democrats in coalition to stop him having to deliver. Second vote was, of course, the referendum on 2016. in which the majority voted to do precisely that. Third vote was in the 2017 election, when both major parties, Labour and Conservative, said, we are going to deliver Brexit. And 85% of people in Britain voted for one of those two parties. So there have been three votes in which a majority of the British people has said, we want to come out. The problem is Parliament is not representative of the British people on that. I mentioned this business, you know. I think you have in America the term the Beltway bubble. Do you? The people living in the Beltway are, we call it the Westminster bubble in Britain. You are completely divorced from the rest of the country. You've no idea what they're talking about, what they're thinking about. You never go into a pub in Newcastle and listen to what ordinary people are saying. You're entirely talking to each other in an echo chamber. You listen to the BBC, you read the Guardian newspaper. Always, you're reinforcing each other's views, and you never actually step north and find out what people in Britain are doing. The problem is that Parliament doesn't actually represent people in Britain, even though, on three occasions, the British people have told them quite clearly what they want to do.
Yes, I have a question. How favorable do you think, or who has, let me put it this way, who has the better bargaining power in terms of Britain negotiating with the rest of Europe, and how favorable do you think these new trade agreements will be for them? How long will it take, and what will they do in the interim period while they're negotiating?
Well, the answer is Europe is a single market, of course, 27 countries apart from Britain, and therefore it is much the heavyweight player in terms of the relative strength of the two negotiating parties. On the other hand, Britain has very good relations with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, United States. You know, we do reach out into a wider world which we call the Anglosphere, that is people who speak and think in English, which includes, pardon me, the United States. That Anglosphere will be Britain's great strength. And our trade with the European Union used to be more than half. It's now dropping. I think next year will just drop below 40%. So it has been diminishing over the years. And the importance of the European Union as a proportion of the world economy has obviously been diminishing, largely the rise of China in India. And so if we do our trade with the Anglosphere and with China and India, yeah, Britain will be in the stronger position then. Not now, but it will be.
Hi. Thank you for your speech, sir. Question about Scotland. In 2014, there was a referendum. And if if Britain goes ahead and leaves, would you care to venture a guess as to whether there might be a second Scottish referendum? And also comment on possible other regional efforts to secede, such as the Basque region or other regions of Europe?
All right, could I first of all declare an interest in that I used to be Scottish? And I want you to note the verb I used there. I used to be Scottish. Half my youthful life was spent in Scotland. I think by the age of 32, I'd spent more than half my life there. I thought of myself as Scottish. I no longer do, by the way. This is very unusual. But mischievously, in that referendum, many people suggested we should look, it takes two to make a divorce. Why is only the Scots? Why are only the Scots being consulted? If we had a referendum in England as to whether to break up the Union, I rather suspect Scottish independence would have been carried. Look, they're costing us a lot of money. They're just a nuisance. Let's get rid of them. And if they really want to practice socialism, they'll be ruined within 2 years, and then, you know, maybe we'll get a decent government. You know, there was a strong kind of English nationalist sentiment at the time. the European Union has a habit of saying, well, we'll give you, if you don't vote the right way, you must do it again. And they did this in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in Ireland. You know, every time you don't vote for what the people in Brussels want, you have to have another referendum. And so now, having rejected independence the first time, we're now going to have another one. And amazingly, Scotland wants to be independent from England, because it wants to assert full sovereignty, while remaining a member of the European Union and having no sovereignty at all. Now, yes, what will happen? It's guesswork. I would say we're extremely unlikely to have a second independent referendum. And part of the reason is that the polls show that people don't want it in Scotland and that they'd vote against it if there was one. The Scottish National Party is not stupid. They're not going to hold a second referendum to lose again, because then it would be gone for a generation. So the odds are very high that it won't happen. Curious enough, that referendum we had in 2014 had one amazing effect. Once the Scottish people had rejected independence, it then became safe to vote for the SNP, the Scottish National Party. They quite like the Scottish National Party governing Scotland as part of the UK. But they didn't vote for them before because there was a threat of independence. Once that was gone, then they could elect an SNP government in Scotland. Paradoxical, but you know, that's what happened. I don't think there will be another independence referendum. And if there were, it would go down again like the last one. The last one went down 55-45 then.
Going twice. I love it when our programs are as timely.
Oh, good. It happens a lot that we seem to be able to have a program right when there's news breaking, and so we thank you for being with us tonight. And indeed, we don't have the EU on this tie,
oh, wow.
But what we do have is capitals of countries that have diplomatic representation in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Wow.
So I hope you will wear it proudly back home, wherever that may be.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for being with us.
Thanks so much.
John, thank you again for being with us and making this possible. John called me about 4:00.